Hi, everybody. We are living at a historical moment, I think, when we are seeing the final implosion or disintegration of the democratic candidate, the democratic profession, the democratic pretense. We've seen it in three debates. They keep saying the lesser evil, and how many people here could say which one? It is impossible to tell. Bush says something horrible, that final exchange about the death penalty. Gore fell to the occasion at once and parroted what Bush had said. Three whole debates. Never once did they talk about the growing gap between rich and poor. Never once did they really talk about the drug war. Never once did they talk about the welfare bill. Three debates in which the reality of our politics and of the world today did not intrude for a second. It's incredible. I do a newsletter with my co-author, Jeffrey. And I was sitting there with Jeffrey, we're looking at this, one of these farces, and I said, will they ever ask him about drugs? After all, Bush is a guy who will not discuss the matter of cocaine in his life before 1974. He has a little sniff still, have you noticed? Gore is a guy who has admitted reluctantly to smoking dope in the 70s. The person who supplied him with dope in the 70s, John Warnke, says he, quote, smoked as much dope as anybody I knew in Tennessee. That's a lot of dope. Anyone from Tennessee here? Put your hands up. So you'd think that even Jim Lehrer, not the most aggressive of questioners, it has to be said, could have said, Mr. Bush, you won't talk about cocaine. Mr. Gore, you smoke dope. Well, all right, marijuana. You both support an insane drug war that has put about hundreds of thousands of non-violent offenders in prison, many of them for lifetimes. You have bipartisan support for a billion-plus aid package to Colombia, which is, as we speak right now, seeing people murdered by Colombian death squads, sponsored in whole by the Colombian military. Do you not think, A, that you, Mr. Bush, owe a proper explanation, and you, Mr. Gore, might discuss your hypocrisy? The issue is really hypocrisy. If any of you want a little summary of the drug issue, one of the many not discussed in this campaign, I just ran off some copies of the front page of our next Counterpunch, and they're here and outside. You might want to grab one. Maybe you can even ask Gore about it next week. Watch my feet here. It's been a particular pleasure watching the humiliation of Gore in these last three debates, because everything that he's made a mess of is a rousing vindication of what Jeffrey and I did in our book. We didn't really think, when we embarked on this, we thought rather humiliating project of having to discover everything about Al Gore, that our book would come out in a pretty exciting atmosphere. That people wouldn't be numbly putting their shoulder to the wheel saying we have to go with Gore. People would be genuinely looking at an exciting alternative in the shape of Ralph Nader. And if ever there was a potent argument for Nader and the Greens, it is the entire career of Al Gore. The entire career from day one. Almost from the first moment that the announcement of his birth was inserted into the Nashville paper by his loving parents. You think I'm going back too far? Gore's dad, Albert, was an old New Dealer. He actually had a moment of honor in his life. He was against the war in Vietnam. And that's the reason he lost his seat in 1970. And that's the one lesson that really sank into the brain of Al Gore Jr. Do not screw up like Dad. Do not take a position of principle. At any time, it might expose you to undue risk. People now wonder why does Gore have this compulsion to tell lies, both small and large? Not the greatest fibber in our political history. I think Ronald Reagan still holds the champion prize for that one. Ronald Reagan said he liberated Auschwitz. It's a large claim, particularly if you never left Hollywood during the war. Al hasn't risen to those heights. Why does he do it? Why did he invent the internet? What is it within him that reaches up and says, exaggerate his role? And you find it in his childhood. His parents were demanding parents. Al was not a rebellious lad. He was a little goody-good. He liked to snitch at school. He went to his team at St. Albans was doing badly one time, and he went to the trainer and he said, "Coach, I'm a little worried about my teammates. They're drinking and smoking late into the evening." That's Al Gore for you. And I think if you have demanding parents who with high expectations, whom you don't see very much of, I thought the most touching lie he told was he said he could remember his mom singing "Look for the Union Label" when he was a kid, when he was a little baby in the cradle. Well, of course, it turned out that the little song was written in the when Al Gore was 27 years old. Big cradle. I think the touching thing was, I don't think Pauline, who's a tough woman, ever sang anything to Al Gore. I don't think she was around very much. And for Al to think Mom might have sung something in the cradle indicates some of the tensions that produce a guy who, to put it favorably, is not at ease in his body. Not at ease in his body. Because he's not at ease in his soul. Because he's like a guy, and you saw this in the debates, he's always twiddling like a fellow with the radio trying to find the right frequency for himself. Who am I? Three different debates, three different me's. He can't find it. And that's why if you're that nervous about who you are, what you might be, it's hard to move with the lithe, natural grace of George Bush or someone like that. If you want a portrait of the bad faith endemic in the whole Gore enterprise, think about the farm in Tennessee. You know, every now and again you'll see a picture of Gore, you know, countryman at home among the trees and the animals back at the farm. The reality of the Gore farm was that the dirt on which the farm rests was owned by Arm & Hammer, one of the great corporate pirates of the 20th century. Arm & Hammer, the CEO of Occidental, had Albert Gore Sr. as his pet senator. Since Arm & Hammer was a crook, he needed senatorial protection. And what he did was he bought some prize bulls and he put them on Gore's land, and every year they'd auction the stock. And the lobbyists would arrive from far Washington and they'd bid $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. for Albert Gore Sr. One calf per auction went for Albert Gore Jr.'s college fund. Now, that was the dirt. The dirt was zinc deposits, which Occidental also owned. So there's the family farm for you. Al goes off to Harvard, where his professor is Martin Peretz. Come on, a little louder, you can do better than that. Owner of the New Republic. Peretz has been one of the leading guiders of the whole turn from early 70s McGovern-type liberalism to pro-Reagan intervention Cold War liberalism. Peretz stands at Gore's elbow today. When the Gore platform today talks about forward engagement, you know what that means? It means accelerated interventions around the world. It's the Peretz style that lies behind that. Unlike Bill, Gore thought it would be good to go fight in Vietnam. You know, it's true. Gore makes Bill look good. He makes him look good. Bill, I thought the other day, you know, with Bill, even when Bill was betraying every single ideal he ever believed in, an almost daily activity in his case, he always looked as though he has a better self to remember. Gore never had a better self. Never for one moment. Bill, you'll remember, Bill dodged the draft and then got into trouble for it. Al decided at Harvard he'd join. A, for his own future political career. B, to help his dad, who was fighting for his political life in 1970. But Al Gore then went and saw General Westmoreland, head of the U.S. Army and of the whole mission in Vietnam, and that not many draftees could do that, and said, "What should I do in Vietnam?" Which meant, of course, how can I be safe in Vietnam? And they made him a journalist. He never ran any risks, which is good. I'm glad he didn't go out and shoot Vietnamese freedom fighters. Came back, wearing his uniform, and said three different things. This is Al Gore. Most people come back with one message. He came back with three. To some people, he said it was a dark midnight of the human soul, and that he would have to go to theological college to purge his sins. That was one. The second one, he said that he had discovered that America did have a mission abroad, and that that mission was to defend freedom. That was the second one. The third one he didn't say publicly, but what his fellow soldiers said is, Al were honest, he'd say he had a great time in Vietnam. Smoked a lot of dope, listened to a lot of music, and just lay around. Three different things. He went to Nashville, Tennessee, and he joined the local paper. And here we find Al, once again, inflating. Later he said, "I did investigative journalism, and I helped to put some guys in jail." Typical Al fib or lie. What did he really do? Actually, he did something very sleazy. There was a local developer who was trying to put up a big office building in Nashville, and the developer came to the paper and said, "There's a local councilman, black councilman, who's taking bribes for zoning variances." So most papers would set up an investigation. They wouldn't do what Gore did, which was to go to the local prosecutor and to the cops and work in cooperation with them to set up a sting. They entrapped the council person. They sent out the developer wearing a wire. They stuck him on a street corner. They took photographs. The developer said, "I'll give you money for the variance." The councilman said, "Okay, $300. Gore sat in the prosecutor's office, this is a reporter, transcribing the tape, and testified to a grand jury hearing before writing his story. This is an incredible piece of behavior for a journalist. Then they go into the council chamber and they arrest the guy, the councilman. The juries saw this as racist entrapment, and the guy was acquitted. That's the Gore journalism story for you in under 2 minutes. Gore went into Congress in the class of 77. Now, that was the class that came in after Watergate. It contained some pretty good people who are quite a fresh crop of feisty Democrats, a lot feistier than they are now. Gore campaigned anti-labor, anti-choice, for mandatory sentencing. He was way ahead of the curve in that one. For the death penalty, of course. Said homosexuality was abnormal. And he gets into the Congress. And what's his first big fight? His first big fight concerns the environment. Now, Gore has, of course, this reputation of being an environmentalist. Most people kind of take it on trust. Ozone Man, the Jolly Green Giant, the guy who wrote Earth in the Balance. There's a thing to know about environmentalism in politics. There's a kind of fuzzy environmentalism where you talk about the planet and its health overall. And there's a real environmentalism where you go after strip miners, you go after timber companies, you go after waste incinerators, you go after powerful corporate interests that are raping the planet. The latter course is not the course that Mr. Gore has taken. And his first big fight in Congress will tell you why. Tennessee is known for its federal projects, TVA, and, of course, Oak Ridge Nuclear Labs. The Army Corps were building a dam on the Tennessee River. The dam had no significant purpose. It wasn't producing hydropower. It wasn't there for water retention. It was there because the Tennessee River had not been dammed. And when the Army Corps sees a river not dammed, they see a task not performed. They did their clear and bounden duty. They said, let the dam be. And of course, the Tennessee delegation said, it is in the nature of the political process that we will defend the noble cement mixers and building contractors of our great state, whose imperishable mission is to build the dam. However, at this point in time, our greatest environmental president, Richard Nixon, no joke, unfortunately, no joke, founded EPA, passed the Endangered Species Act. And some biologists said, in the Tennessee River there's a snail darter, a little minnow. The building contractor said, little fish? The Tennessee political delegation rallied as one. And they said, the minnow must die and the dam must rise. It went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, the law is clear. The dam must go down. The minnow must survive. Then Gore and Howard Baker set up the God Squad, which we've still got. The God Squad is a team of people. They sit down and they balance. On the one hand, the snail darter, part of God's creation. On the other hand, building contractors, also part of God's creation. Which weighs most heavily in the scale of things? The building contractors, you know, have to buy cars, spend money, or the little snail darter? The God Squad said, the snail darter, let the snail darter prevail. Let the building contractors go build something else. The dam, by the way, was nearly complete. At midnight, Gore and his allies attached what's known as a sufficiency rider to an appropriations bill in Congress. With few people present, that said, all laws notwithstanding, this rider dictates that all other laws be set aside in the Tellico Dam. And that was it. That was the first major hole driven in the Endangered Species Act. The first major erosion of one of our greatest environmental laws. And Gore was the guy who did it. I was laughing the other day. I was reading it in These Times. They had an article attacking NADA's environmental record. You know, Ralph had already pretty much written the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act before Gore had even got into Congress to drive a hole through the Endangered Species Act. Ralph had already done that. Who is the better legislator between the two? You know, when we did this book, we found an interesting thing. It's very hard to find people in the Congress who like Gore. You know, normally you find someone, yes, Gore, very fine legislator, terrific guy. Very hard to find it. No one in the Congress really likes Gore. Because he was what they call a glory boy. You mean you get into the House and you're already running for the Senate. You get into the Senate and you're already running for the presidency. That's always been Gore's style. He arranged his life in the House that he would be in, he'd hold hearings which would attract national television. He was on the investigation subcommittee of the Science and Technology Committee. I'm sure most of you knew that, but I just thought I'd remind you about it. And in that place, he held hearings which seemed dramatic. They didn't really offend corporate power very much. They were things like flame retardant infant nightwear. So he'd haul along the maker of nightwear, some guy, and he'd shout at him, you mean to say that these nightdresses might burst into flame at any minute? Oh, yes, they might. You know, terrific TV. When it came to a tough issue, Gore took a dive. I'll give you an example. A journalist I know, in 1980, it was gradually emerging that the AEC, the ancestor of the Department of Energy, had been overseeing secret experiments on Americans in which they were injected with plutonium without their knowledge, exposed to very high levels of radiation covertly. At Oak Ridge, Tennessee, there was a program they were doing for NASA. NASA was worried that people in space, the astronauts, would be exposed to solar flares, and they wanted to know how they'd hold up. So they said to the people in Oak Ridge, could you run a few tests? Oak Ridge said, oh, of course we can. Thank you. We would love to do that. The people in Oak Ridge, being patriotic scientists, immediately went around looking for kids who had advanced leukemia. Then they would say to the parents of these kids, there's one last chance. For little Dwayne. This kid was called Dwayne. There's one last chance. We can give him a really high shot of radiation and maybe it'll turn things around. The parents of Dwayne, the dad was a dollar an hour mechanic at Oak Ridge. The mom was a working class woman. Dwayne was 3 or 4 years old. They put Dwayne in this room with 50 cages of white mice and they zapped him for several weeks, at the end of which little Dwayne died. He was going to die anyway, but he died, but his parents had that last hope. And this was gradually being unearthed by various people, including this particular journalist. He went to Gore's office, and he said, you know, I'm going down to Tennessee, and I wanted to poke around at Oak Ridge, and Gore said, fine, go ahead. I mean, away you go. Then he came back. He came into Gore's office and Gore said, you know, I wish I'd never seen you. I wish I'd never seen you. And the guy said, why? He said, I'm running for high office. I cannot afford to annoy Oak Ridge is politically very powerful in Tennessee. It's got more PhDs per square foot than anywhere else on the planet. Huge investment. They're potent. And the guy said, the journalist, he doesn't want to be named because he still has to deal with the White House. He said, you know, wouldn't it be good to do the right thing for Dwayne Sexton, his parents? And Gore pointed at the picture of his dad on the wall and said, he did the right thing and see where it got him. So Gore held hearings, but they weren't like the other hearings. They were very quick. On the one hand, there was just Dwayne Sexton's mother, lonely, nervous, frightened woman. Gore was very neutral with her, indifferent. On the other hand, there were all these scientists from Oak Ridge, and Gore was extremely deferential. Oh, yes, thank you very much, Professor. Very illuminating, Professor. Well, the hearings were over in the afternoon, and that was that. That tells you a lot about Gore. Gore gets into the Senate. Now, in those days in the Senate, if you were a candidate for the presidency, you had to do a number of things. Among them, you had to show that you were sophisticated in national security. Really, what you had to do was show that you were prepared to blow up the planet. You had to be able, the question was always put, you probably heard it, you know, do you have sufficient resolve, candidate, to face up to the Soviet Union? I do. Would you be prepared to, and they'd always basically have, yes, I would be prepared to press button A. Gore decided to make a name for himself by intervening in a big national debate, which some of you may remember. On the one hand, there was the nuclear freeze movement. 1982, there were 1 million people in Central Park in New York. 1 million people for the freeze. It was a very powerful movement. On the other hand, the national security complex wanted to deploy the MX. Some of you may remember that Jimmy Carter wanted to deploy the MX on railway trains running around the West. The idea was that you'd put the MX on railways and they would move through Utah, Nevada, New Mexico, and the Russians wouldn't be able to target it. You know, they'd point their missiles at Provo, Utah, and by that time the MX would have snuck off to New Mexico. And the MX would go thundering around the West on its railway train. You'd be able to tell the time, look at your, oh, there goes the MX as it went by. The people who lived in the West didn't want this. They said, we don't want the MX on going by every day or twice a day or even once a week. We didn't want it at all. So the Reagan people were desperately trying to get political support for their other deployment, which was called DensPAC, where you have them all in one place. Into this debate came Gore. He said, I have a win-win solution, a compromise. Now, like most compromises, when they see him from our side, it wasn't so much of a compromise. He said to the freeze movement, I've got an idea, a new nuclear missile called Midget Man, smaller than the MX. Won't that satisfy you? And they said, no, we want a freeze. We don't want another missile. The Reagan people said, well, that's a very good idea, Congressman Gore. Very splendid idea. We approve of that idea. And if we let you have Midget Man, you'll surely let us have MX. And Gore said, that seems like a wise statesmanlike compromise. And so it came to pass. The Democrats came in behind Gore. MX got through, and not a single Midget Man was ever built. That's Gore the strategist, who only this week is now invoking the name of Ronald Reagan as a man in whose great tradition he stands. And the tradition is Midget Man. And that whole process, you know, is very educative about how the real to and fro of the parties work. The method is always that you have a threat over here and a compromise over here, and the compromise over here turns out to be the threat you were looking at in the first place. Some of you may remember James Watt. Remember James Watt? No, don't hiss. Watt was so stupid that I like to think that he set back the course of environmental destruction by about 10 years. Set back. Watt came into power as Reagan's interior secretary, and he said, you know, there won't be a redwood standing when I'm done. We'll have a McDonald's in every national park, and we won't have many national parks because we're going to privatize them anyway. The environmental movement rallied. They raised millions and millions of dollars. Actually, too much money, because they had so much money because of Watt. Because they ran pictures of polar bears defiant, grizzly bears standing back, eagles flying defiantly in the face of Watt. Millions of money came flowing into the Sierra Club, the Wilderness Society, the World Wildlife Fund, the National Audubon, that they were richer than they'd ever been before. And then, being feisty environmentalists, they decided to buy bigger office buildings in Washington, hire more people, buy more computers. So by now they have to raise more money next year to finance all the stuff they'd bought the first year, which is what happened to mainstream environmentalism, in case you've been wondering. The threat of Watt was there. Finally, Watt was pushed out. Everybody declared an enormous victory. In come, ultimately, the Democrats. And now they say, we must break gridlock. 1992, 1993, Clinton and Gore said, we must break the gridlock. Now, whenever you hear those words, beware. Remember, we like gridlock. It's the only thing we've got. It's like, you know, liberals, I sometimes hear them saying, we want weapons that work. No, we don't. We want weapons that don't work. You know, we should be in favor of Star Wars. It will never work. George Bush says, get Star Wars and I'll cut the nuclear arsenal. That's a great position. We're in favor of it. You remember what Al Gore said when Bush said, we'll cut the nuclear arsenal, let's have 25,000 nuclear bombs and not 50,000? Gore said, that's destabilizing. Destabilizing. That's what Gore said. So, just to finish the gridlock story, in 93 they come in, they say, we'll break the gridlock. What happened? They had a big powwow in the Pacific Northwest. They said, less logging, orderly logging. Let's destroy the forest in an orderly way. And it's been going on. You may not have looked lately. The only impediment to the destruction has been a federal judge in Seattle, appointed by Ronald Reagan, William Dwyer, who has tried to stop it. At the rate they're going, the spotted owl, which is the indicator species there to tell you what's really going on, will be extinct on the Olympic Peninsula by 2004. Orderly destruction. The Everglades. They said, let's clean up the Everglades. The sugar lobby spoke as one. The Everglades haven't been cleaned up. You have Babbitt as the Interior Secretary. It says, we want win-win solutions. Whenever you hear win-win, you know that a horrible confidence trick is being perpetrated. The biggest example of win-win is going on in the West right now, where the Southern California real estate industry was confronted once again with the Endangered Species Act. They said, we can have a win-win solution. They said, they've learned to speak the lingo now. They say, we will respect the habitat of the gnatcatcher and the red-legged frog. They've learned not to say, who cares about frogs? They say, we'll respect the habitat. Even get their mouth around the word habitat. So the frog and the gnatcatcher get a little bit of rocky ledge that they can't build a house on. And the developers get the other habitat, which of course is what they want. And they've even learned, I was doing a story on them, they've learned to use the word wildlife corridor. It's like hearing Tamburlaine say United Nations, a wildlife corridor. I said, well, where is the wildlife corridor for the gnatcatcher and the red-legged frog? And it was a concrete culvert under the interstate. So every night, the gnatcatcher and the frog line up, and they go through the culvert. They probably meet a bunch of Mexicans coming the other way, and that is the... That's a win-win solution, you know? So in the middle of all this, Gore, in 88, he runs for the presidency. He's 40 years old. We have a chapter on it in the book. The plan was for Gore to sweep this up, and then there'd be a brokered convention, and he would go on to victory. Well, of course, as you may remember, 88 was the year that Jesse Jackson ran, when Jesse Jackson was a real populist, before he kind of cashed in his chips and became a Democratic Party hack. And he is a Democratic Party hack. Let's face it. Jackson was carrying all before him. The apparent guy who was going to get the nomination was Dukakis. Gore did very badly. He did badly in the South. He did badly everywhere. Yet he went on to New York. Why did he go into New York? He had not a hope of winning. He was given the task by the Democratic leadership of finishing off Jackson. He went around New York with Mayor Ed Koch, attacking Jackson at every turn. And it had an effect. Jackson lost momentum by the time he was heading for California. And it was in that campaign that Gore introduced the American people to Willie Horton. He was the first person to use Willie Horton against Dukakis, and as a symbol basically appealing to white racism. And that, of course, was picked up by George Bush in the fall, in the most racist campaign in recent memory. That was Al Gore's gift. Gore, in the middle 80s, by the way, the best known Gore was not Al at all. It was Tipper. Yeah, I guess. Tipper conceived the first major campaign for what has now become a familiar scene, the campaign for family values, the campaign against rock, the campaign against rap. And the thing she founded, the PMRC, was a pretty heavy exercise in censorship. These days she says, no, we weren't trying to censor things. Oh yes, they were. We have a chapter on it. They were involved in deep negotiations with the recording industry in Hollywood to prevent certain groups from ever getting contracts. It was a straight exercise in blacklisting. Furthermore, she was in league with extremely racist right-wing Christian forces, groups that used to talk about Martin Luther King. That's the kind of country they were in. This brings us back to the old bait and switch. Just like the environmentalists used what? Outfits like The Nation, liberal outfits, People for the American Way, used for years the threat of the Christian right. Pat Robertson, he would come in, he would sweep into power, and every main street in America, the brown shirts are waiting to march. Give some money to The Nation magazine.